special way. That was Donny Hathaway, of course, with Roberta Flack. On this day in 1979, the great singer Donny Hathaway committed suicide, falling from a 15th floor in a New York hotel. Was one of our great singers, along with Roberta Flack. And I remember meeting him at a concert here in Baltimore, doing one of our campaigns here in the city, and lovely human being that passed away on this day. We are going to now look at the War on Poverty, a two-hour special here on the Mark Steiner Show. We begin by talking about its history, about where it began and why it began, what America was like at that moment, and where we've come to since then in that time. We are joined by Dr. Peniel Joseph, who is a professor of history at Tufts University, author of Waiting Till Midnight Hour, a narrative history of Black Power in America, and Dark Days, Bright Nights, from Black Power to Barack Obama. And we are joined by Dr. Annalise Orlick, who is professor of history at Dartmouth College, author of Storming Caesar's Palace, How Black Mothers Fought Their Own War on Poverty, and co-editor of The War on Poverty, A New Grassroots History, 1964 to 1980, an amazing book, and Timothy Casey, director of Women and Poverty Program at Legal Momentum. He just wrote the report, Too Little Progress About the War on Poverty After 50 Years. And folks, welcome. Good to have you all three with us.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Folks, you can join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Log on to our Facebook page. I see two people have written there already. We'll go to see what you have to say. You can tweet us at Mark Steiner, your thoughts on this war on poverty, where we are in America today and where we were. Let me begin, if I might, with you, Dr. Annalise Orlick, and just to take us back to this moment. What was going on in America that allowed this kind of motivated and allowed America to be taken by this war on poverty? It's a very different kind of place we're in now. Where were we then?
Well, first of all, there was a fairly high poverty rate. The estimates vary from, you know, between 22% to 25%. So you had persistently high rate of poverty. A couple of years before, Michael Harrington's The Other America had come out giving a sense of how many people in the country were living a life of grinding poverty and spirit affecting. And I think in the aftermath of 10 years of civil rights activism, Lyndon Johnson really tried to create a vision that mixed the goals of racial justice and the goals of economic justice. And in May of 64, a little bit after his declaration of war on poverty in January of that year, he said he laid out his vision for a great society, and it was a vision that included satisfying the hunger for community, satisfying the desire that people had to live, you know, more than just a materially comfortable life. But I think that there was a feeling on the part of many people, and he really did throw down the gauntlet and say this is a moral imperative, that government could do something good. It was kind of the high water mark of 20th century liberalism, this idea that government was a positive force for good and a tool. And Johnson, of course, was the master legislator. You know, this was a man who believed that he could, and indeed did, lay out a raft of legislation that transformed American government every bit as much as Roosevelt's New Deal, and that we continue to live with today: Medicare, Medicaid, educational funding, jobs programs. The jobs programs are the major thing that we've lost. And I think in the 50th anniversary, and as Barack Obama prepares, to lay out his agenda for the last 2 years, that's something perhaps that we can come back to.
Yeah, we need to come back to that, and we will. And Dr. Peniel Joseph, welcome. Good to have you all with us. We're going to have you with us. Let's focus on people also in the war in that period. We're talking about 1964 when he declared this war on poverty. And it was also on the back of things that Bayard Rustin had written about a freedom budget for America and about what came out of the civil rights movement.
No, absolutely. I mean, what's interesting, when LBJ, and I agree with everything that Annalise was saying, when LBJ does that State of the Union on January 8th, it's about 45 days after the Kennedy assassination, and it's a few months after the March on Washington, and really 63 is this epical year. And yeah, he is taking from not just Michael Harrington, but things that people like Bayard Rustin, and Rustin is getting this from his time as a social democratic activist, and he's really mentored by people like A. Philip Randolph, who is head of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, who had been a socialist in the 1920s and really thought that economic transformation was the engine to racial equality. So when we think about the war on poverty, and even that State of the Union address, he's addressing things like infrastructure, he's addressing immigration, he's addressing all these different many-folded and many-layered parts of American society. And his whole notion of a great society is this vision of racial and economic justice as being primary to a progressive democracy. And he's taking that from the movement. But one thing we can add is that in that same speech, he also talks about tax cuts. So one of the contradictions, and Martin Luther King Jr. is going to push him on this between 65 and 68, is a couple of things. People talk about Vietnam a lot.
Yeah.
But Johnson's own State of the Union speech, he's trying to do this grand vision on the cheap, and that's a problem. So he's saying, look, we're going to, he mentions tax cuts throughout the speech, too. I mean, it's an extraordinary speech. He mentions a strong military and a strong defense, right? He mentions world peace, but we're going to have to fight for it. So it's an extraordinary speech filled with contradictions, but his war on poverty, the main source is the Office of Economic Opportunity. And again, the budget is never going to be as wide as, one, when wartime spending becomes really big, a Gulf of Tonkin, and by the time 65 occurs, we're sending in troops, and the high water mark is going to be sort of 69, 70. He wants to do this gigantic, great society, but he's telling us that we can afford it, and he's actually going to cut the federal deficit, right? So there's all these contradictions to his vision of a great society.
Timothy Casey, pick up on that point. I mean, because that part of it, what happened at that moment were those contradictions. The Vietnam War, trying to cut taxes, people arguing that there wasn't enough put into it, into the war on poverty. It did amazing things, but what else could it have done? But talk about, to pick up from there.
Well, I think there have been two clear gains resulting from the war on poverty. One was the expansion of health care coverage for the poor and for the non-poor through Medicaid and Medicare, and more recently Obamacare. Although, unlike other high-income countries, we still have many people in this country who lack access to health care coverage. But one gain was a tremendously important expansion. And the other really important positive outcome of the war on poverty was a major reduction in the poverty rate for senior citizens from well over 20% to now less than 10%. So those are the two major gains. But in other areas, there has been very little progress, if any, in reducing poverty. And today, I think we face an economy in which there's been a huge growth in low-wage work. The minimum wage, it used to be half of the average wage. Now it's only about one-third of the average wage, and we have a tremendous amount of low-wage work in this country. And there have also been some significant cutbacks in public benefits in our welfare program, so that today most poor families no longer receive cash assistance from the welfare program, and there's been a tremendous increase in deep poverty among families with children. So we need to move forward as we look to the future. We need to raise the minimum wage and overall to reduce the amount of low-wage work in this country, increase employment, but reduce low-wage work. And we need to expand our public benefit system.
I do want to get to the point of where we are today, which we're going to do in a few minutes with you all before we talk about in the next hour how we're going to how to redefine poverty in the 21st century. But one of the things that strikes me, Annalise, is that everything Timothy is saying, I think, from my perspective, is correct. It's also true that the war on poverty, despite its limitations and the money people said was not enough that was put into the program, it had, and that in combination with the other things he put out there, had an enormous effect on cutting the numbers of people who are mired in the deepest poverty in America. I think we forget that as well.
Yeah, I think that I spoke to one reporter last week who said he'd never heard anyone say that it had been a success, and that's
right.
Really astonishing, because It did cut child poverty in half in 10 years. Between 67 and 2012, it cut poverty overall by something like 40%. Now, I think that Timothy's point is a really important one. The constant fall during that same period in real wages has been really crucial. And, you know, so jobs that, and some of that is a result of the continued decline of the labor movement. Some of it is the result of deregulation. So, I mean, I think wages are really a key issue. But it expanded the community health center program, expanded life expectancy in poor neighborhoods. The child poverty rate dropped. Overall, and the kinds of poverty that you saw among children as unconscionable as our high poverty rate is today among children, we're not seeing the same levels of malnutrition and the symptoms of long-term malnutrition that we saw then. You know, sores,
right.
Bow legs, signs of rickets. Those kinds of things have been, hopefully, forever improved by the passage of food stamps, by the Women and Infant Children Nutrition Program, by some of the early screening programs for poor children. And those remain with us, though they have been cut. Those programs do remain, and they really should be talked about as part of the success of the war on poverty.
I think, again, that what you're saying, Lisa, is important. Before we get into what that's led us to in the 21st century, Peniel, I mean, I think that, again, some of those of us who were kind of alive and active at that moment, even though I was very young as a teenager, poverty was – people are poor in America today, and it's horrendous. But what Annalise was describing about the – medical and physical condition of people in poverty. That's the thing that Michael Harrington helped expose in The Other America. That's the stuff that Bayard Rustin was talking about. That's the stuff that the civil rights movement exposed. And we don't get a sense of how hard it was, really, at that moment in our history just 50 years ago.
No, absolutely. I mean, I think one of the big things about the war on poverty is the way in which it is going to alleviate poverty in places like Mississippi, in places like Alabama, in the Delta, where people are still sharecropping. And there's going to be, Mississippi sort of child development groups and movements where the war on poverty is taken up by local people to try to do things, everything from schooling to providing people with nutrition. It's also going to be spurred by local activism as well, because before the federal government, for example, federalizes free lunch and free breakfast, we're going to have groups in the 1960s like the Black Panther Party who are organizing free breakfast and lunch programs. And the Panthers are a great example because they actually use war on poverty funds to initially organize themselves.
Now, people don't know. Say that one more time. People don't remember that fact. That's an important point, I think, levels historically.
Bobby Steele and Huey Newton are working at a North Oakland anti-poverty center, and they're working there, and they're using that mimeograph machine in the fall of 1966 when they come out with the what we want, what we believe, really a 20-point program that sometimes people refer to as a 10-point program. That gives you the raison d'etre of the Panthers. But even though the Panthers are usually thought of as, gun-toting black urban militants, a lot of what they were trying to do as socialists was anti-poverty and eliminate poverty and transform what they argued was an exploitative system. But the free breakfast program, free lunch program, by the early 70s, they're giving away thousands of free dinners and shoes, and there's buses to prison programs, there's ambulance programs, they create a health clinic in Chicago. It's really formulated around ending poverty. And even when we think about activists like Stokely Carmichael and people who were connected to both civil rights and black power, they worked in places like the Mississippi Delta and in places like Lowndes County, Alabama, places that many Americans have never, ever been to and never will be. I've been to those places doing research. And there are parts of the country that don't look like urban America, even connected to the states they live in. So if you go to the Delta in Mississippi doesn't look like Oxford, Mississippi. Doesn't look like Jackson, Mississippi.
Right, right.
If you go to Lowndes County, Alabama, Lowndes does not look like Birmingham, Alabama. All right, and people live there. There's like people living there day to day, and in the '60s, that those it was even worse. So I think the interesting parts about anti-poverty is the way in which, irrespective of ideology, many groups from radical to revolutionary to liberal were interested in sort of exposing that poverty, but depending on their ideology, they had different solutions. So the more radical and revolutionary said that this is happening because not only wages are low, but this whole system is corrupt, where other people thought they could reform. And even Dr. King admits in Where Do We Go From Here, Chaos or Community, that reform won't be enough. So what's interesting is that King, I think deep in his heart, always knew that, but publicly he crosses a Rubicon by the late 60s where he's advocating and you know, the Poor People's Campaign, a Poor People's Movement, but saying that systematically, fundamentally, something has to change.
And, you know, I think during that time also, Timothy Casey, is when we formulated this definition of poverty that I think is important to put in here, because that was part of it, the Olshansky poverty thresholds, as they were called. But Molly Olshansky, who was this economist working with Social Security, defined what poverty meant then. And that's part of what we're still struggling with today.
Right, and one of the problems with the poverty definition is that it ignores the gains in health care coverage that have come through the Medicaid, the Medicare, and the community health program. So those gains, because we count poverty only by measuring cash income against a dollar amount income level that defines who's poor, and that doesn't recognize the gains in health care coverage and life expectancy and overall well-being as a result of the expansion of health care coverage. So that's an important point that the listeners should be aware of. But nevertheless, while there has been progress, particularly in the health care area and some progress in racial justice, nevertheless, the racial and gender and social inequities that existed when the war on poverty was declared still exist today.
Right.
Women are still much more likely to be poor than men. Blacks are still much more likely to be poor than whites. Hispanics are much more likely to be poor than non-Hispanics. So children are much more likely to be poor than adults. So there are major inequities that still exist today and that we need new policies to address.
And I do want to talk about where we have come to today. What does warm poverty beginning in 1964 means for where we are today in 2014? I think this is an important this is a 50-year gap, this 50-year struggle, this 50-year leap. Where are we today, and what does all that mean for the moment we're in now? Is what we're going to tackle as soon as we come back from this very brief break. And we're going to go out here again with a little bit more Donny Hathaway, appropriately the ghetto. Donny Hathaway had died on this day, and we remember him with his music. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. Good to have you all with us as we look at the war on poverty declared by President Lyndon Johnson in 1964, and his most famous speech on that was given actually 49 years ago today in 1965. And we are here with Dr. Peniel Joseph, professor of history at Tufts University, author of Waiting Till the Midnight Hour, a narrative history of black power in America, and Dark Days, Bright Nights, From Black Power to Barack Obama. He's written a new biography of Stokely Carmichael. We're looking forward to talking to him about that in the coming weeks. Dr. Annalise Orlick is with us. She's professor of history at Dartmouth College, author of Storming Caesar's Palace, How Black Mothers Fought Their Own War on Poverty, and is co-editor of The War on Poverty, A New Grassroots History, 1964 to 1980. Timothy Casey is director of the Women and Poverty Program at Legal Momentum, and recently wrote a report, Too Little Progress, about the War on Poverty After 50 Years. 410-319-8888 is the number here. You can also write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. We'll go to Michael, who's our first call up in just a minute. And you can also tweet us at Mark Steiner. You know, we're talking about, let me just get to some things of where we are now. You know, this is, as you were saying before we went to break, Timothy Casey, there are a lot of racial and gender inequities in poverty in America, huge gaps. We also forget within that, Annalise Orlick, that there are, depending on by what measure you use, using the old poverty measures that we use in America still today, that if you use kind of this demographic statistics that America has, there's between 19 and 22 million people who are white who live in poverty in America now.
Yeah, I mean, the larger number of poor for a very long time were always white because the white population was
larger.
You know, was a sizable majority in the United States. And Lyndon Johnson highlighted that when he started the war on poverty by making some of his first speeches, announcing it in Appalachia, sitting on the front porch of a miner's cabin, and talking about the pockets of intractable poverty for white people. And one of the things that needs to be highlighted, of course, is that this is seen as, because it was in some ways an answer to the protests of the civil rights era, it's seen as a story in, you know, of reaching out to black people and to addressing their long-term poverty in many pockets of the black community. But in fact, it was a situation that affected everyone, and groups that weren't thought of as poor responded to the war on poverty. Long-time problems of inadequate housing and overcrowding in Chinese immigrant communities, completely inadequate infrastructure, lack of water often, and lack of winterization in houses in Native American communities across the country. Many kinds of other poverty-related issues in Hispanic communities in places like San Antonio and Los Angeles and in New York and in Puerto Rican Bronx neighborhoods. So I think what happened is that a lot of these community groups, and I wanted to pick up on what Peniel was saying, a lot of community groups in these areas were able to get themselves funded with war on poverty money, and to build on the idea that was built into the 1964 Economic Opportunity Act, that to really address poverty, we have to have, quote, maximum feasible participation by the poor themselves. And that's what the war on poverty did. You had people knowing what their communities needed, framing and proposing projects to the federal government, and then delivering on those projects, delivering housing, building clinics and running clinics. And some of those clinics were remarkable. I mean, in Durham, North Carolina, they were white and black mothers working together in a still segregated city. In Las Vegas, where I've written about, the community clinic became remarkably organized, involving, you know, African-Americans, the white poor, Mexican Americans, Native Americans, Asians, and Pacific Islanders. I think you saw kind of an extension and an expansion of the beloved community of the civil rights era, and definitely an expansion of the political class. And that's, I think, what we lack today, and what we really need to think about and try to find ways to go back to.
I'm going to go to the phones here. Well, what you just said, Annalise, I think is a critical piece of this in terms of what's happening today. That in terms of organizing as opposed to then, a lot of the stuff, as you pointed out as well, Peniel, that happened at that period of people organizing against poverty and fighting poverty were because people were federally funded and began to organize their own communities. I mean, that was a big piece of this.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. And in fact, it's sort of an unintended consequence, which is one of the reasons why conservatives are going to say, you know, the war on poverty and the community action programs and that idea of maximum feasible participation provides a context for subversives and for communists and for socialists and for black militants to use war on poverty funds for their own nefarious deeds. Amiri Baraka, who just died last week, used funds that were from the Harlem Youth Act, which are, you know, anti-poverty funds, in the summer of 1965 for his Black Arts Repertory Theater and School, and used about $40,000 worth of funds to have a roving library. He had Sun Ra and his orchestra there, jazz, poetry, speeches through the whole summer of 1965, which really transformed the literary cultural context of that period, and really inspires the Black Arts Movement that we're going to see in the 1960s. So people definitely used it for their own own means, but its most radical edge was to try to use it to create a kind of consciousness among poor people. You know, Annalise has written extensively about this in terms of national welfare rights.
Right.
And it's not just its national iteration, but really its local iteration, and what she talks about in Las Vegas. You know, she turns in Storming Caesar's Palace, Las Vegas, into a site of real radical insurgent politics that no one had really talked about before, and that's multiracial, multicultural, multigenerational, and it's feminism, but it's also radical democratic action, you know, which we never really think of as being multicultural, multiracial, multigenerational.
And I'm going to go to the phones here. And at the end, the last half an hour of this program today, the next hour, we're going to be joined by those activists, 21st century version of those activists, who are now working in communities all around in the same way, because that spirit is here, but not funded as well. And also maybe in some ways it's not as militant, but maybe that's wrong. 410-319-8888 is the number here, and we'll also look at our Facebook pages, people have written in. Michael, you're on the air.
Hi, Mark. Michael Campbell. How you doing?
Very well. Welcome.
All right. I really appreciate this conversation, and I'll just start by saying I'm not a huge historian, particularly on this topic, but I do, as I come from a holistic wellness perspective. I'm a wellness coach and a life coach, and when we talk about wellness, you know, it covers, expands the entire circle of life. And so, I think...
You there, Michael?
I come from the perspective that perception is everything, and when we talk about the war on anything, specifically poverty, we're talking about war. And I think that the word war conjures up a thought and behavior and actions that would be different if we use different words. And again, I'm kind of bringing in a metaphysical perspective that really does address the system that you distinguished earlier, that I think, you know, this issue really stems from it. You know, it's a systemic issue, and you need to deal with the root cause of whatever it is. And so instead of saying war on poverty, perhaps we could say taking a stand for prosperity, you know, which would give, I think, you know, a different behavior, as does, you know, the glass half full, the glass half empty.
Oh, well, that
kind of relates to it differently. So that was it. I'm not sure if this applies to the conversation.
No, I appreciate the thought. I appreciate the thought. Let's wrestle with that. Timothy Case, why don't you pick up on that point? I mean, the idea of how we refer to things and why we refer to it then as a war on poverty, and some people still do.
Well, I think it had both a plus, you know, and a minus side to it. The plus side was that it focused attention on a major set of problems, poverty and its consequences. But on the other hand, among many people, the idea that we would help only one group be poor, and we're not the poor, so what is in this for us? So it's also a divisive way of thinking about the problem. So I'm not sure that different terminology would have had ultimately changed the consequence of the outcomes, but I do think it is important to talk about these issues in a holistic way that doesn't divide, that brings us together, that makes us contribute to a sense of social solidarity, which, if we believe just about the poor and them being someone else, doesn't really get us where we want to be.
Go ahead, please, Annalise.
Yeah, if I could just jump in with the vision of some of the welfare rights activists, which was a mother's vision and which I think addresses the caller's concern in a very beautiful way. The way Ruby Duncan, the leader of the Las Vegas anti-poverty movement, put it was, she said, my political vision is this: what I want for my children, I want for all children. And that she imagined, you know, a society restructured along those lines. And I think whether it's a vision of a mother or a father or, you know, anyone who cares about children, I think that's a really very different approach. And it was quite alive in the 1960s, and I think would attract people today as well.
There's a piece written here, I mean, just on our Facebook page before we go to our next callers who called in. Doug Brentschneider wrote in, the war on poverty, like the war on drugs, is a miserable failure. Our government, big banks, and big corporations are in the midst of the greatest wealth transfer in the history of the world. In plain view, in front of everyone, without apology, they've sacked our economy and are lining their pockets at the expense of and on the backs of the middle class. So they are coming to be known as the working poor. I think it's time to flip the script. Charlene Gross writes in, the middle class is becoming extinct. Peniel, how would you respond to them when you look at this war on poverty 50 years?
Well, I don't think it was a failure. I just think that it's only a failure to the extent that we did not end up eradicating poverty. And we also had a movement for full employment in the country, and we did not end up succeeding in terms of employing everybody who wanted to work in the country. But in terms of what the war on poverty and anti-poverty measures have done, and I would actually add the Affordable Care Act to this as well, because the Affordable Care Act, there's going to be a tax on people. There's a tax on people who are basically wealthy. They're going to be paying $45,000 in taxes more per year, which was one of the reasons why conservatives and those who represent them in Congress were really against the Affordable Care Act. So that is a wealth redistribution act, which I think is very, very positive. So what the war on poverty did, and when we think about Medicare and Medicaid, and when we think about Head Start and the different transfers, what these did was set federal money aside in perpetuity for people who had the least amount of money and the least wherewithal for child care, who were elderly, who were unemployed. That's a good thing. What has happened, though, and I agree with this person, is that in the last 40 years, really since 1970, when we think about stagflation, because some people say it's since 1980, but it really starts before then. When we think about stagflation, stagnant economy, inflationary prices, and what goes on under the Nixon administration, real wages have continued to fall steadily over the last 43 years in the United States for working people. Now, from that perspective, what has occurred is this consolidation of income, and it's not just since the Great Recession, but it's over these last, especially since the Reagan era. Warren Buffett has written eloquently in the New York Times that in 1976, when the top bracket for investors was 39.5%, him and many millionaires and people who became billionaires still invested, yet capital gains and all these different taxes have been cut and lowered and lowered and lowered, and we have the carried interest where people are making tens and hundreds of millions of dollars and being untaxed or virtually untaxed on it. So I do believe that that's correct, that there's been a consolidation of income, and that's really impacted our political process, because we have a political process in the United States where, whether it's the Tea Party or conservatives, all they're doing is representing the interests of 1% of the entire country, yet their decisions affect 100% of the country. So I agree that that's something that's very, very disturbing. People thought the election of Obama was going to defeat that movement, but what it did was curtail it, because we can't stress enough to people how big the Affordable Care Act is in terms of as a redistributive anti-poverty act, and the people who are going to benefit the most from that are people who are poor.
Dr. Peniel Joseph, I know you have to run. He's a professor of history at Tufts University. We'll have him back soon for his newest book on Stokely Carmichael. Peniel, thank you so much for joining us once again.
Thank you for having me.
Good to have you here. And let me introduce now to our panel, Dr. Michael Rice, who joins us. He's a Daniel Thurs Distinguished Professor of Social Justice at the University of Maryland. Good to see you again, Michael.
Thank you, Mark.
So let's talk. Let me let you lead off here to talk about the redefinition of what you think should be the redefinition of poverty in 2014, as opposed to when it was declared, this war on poverty in 1964?
Well, one thing is, just from a statistical standpoint, there's been something introduced that called the Supplemental Poverty Measure, and that takes into account two things. One, changes in family budgets, what comprises a family budget, which is considerably different from what it was 50 years ago. I mean, what Marley Olshansky developed in 1963 at the Social Security Administration was based upon the Agriculture Department's notion of what was a minimum subsistence diet. She was just doing it for research purposes to try to determine how many people were, in fact, poor. And then it became interpreted as the basis for a poverty line. We've essentially been using that for the past 50 years to measure poverty. There's been a lot of concern on both the left and the right that this is an incorrect measure. The left argues that there are different expenses today, that such as health care and housing, which have grown much more rapidly than inflation. The right argues that we don't count in certain benefits that people get, such as welfare, food stamps, and so forth. So economists have developed the supplemental poverty measure, which in fact shows that the poverty rate has been actually higher, and it is now about 16% in the United States, and that consistently over the past 45 years, the supplemental poverty measure would show a slightly higher poverty rate than the official poverty measure. Now, again, this takes into account the benefits that people get from things like Social Security and TANF and what's now called SNAP or food stamps.
Tax credits.
Yeah, earned income tax credit,
right.
All those other things. So that's one aspect of it. But the other part of it is that we have a very different society than we did 50 years ago. People have different needs in order to survive. I mean, I think one thing that a lot of the discussion has completely overlooked is the transformation of the U.S. and global economy in the last half century. I mean, at the beginning of the 1960s, the United States was at the end of a period in which it was the colossus of the world economy. In the 1950s, the United States produced over half of the manufactured goods in the world. Other countries were still decimated and recovering from the Second World War. That situation is never, ever going to arise again. And I think we have to make adjustments in our anti-poverty policy based upon the recognition that the world and the U.S. economy are significantly different. There's no way that a person is going to be able to live a middle-class or middle-income lifestyle anymore with a high school education. It's just not going to happen. I mean, areas that I've lived in, like in Southeast Michigan, there were auto workers there who lived a fairly decent life because of gains that had been made by unions like the UAW and
right.
Agreements that were made with corporate leaders because they had to reach accommodation with labor if they wanted to maintain their position in the world economy. That situation is not there anymore, and I think we have to recognize that. So the strategies that have to develop. I mean, I would certainly support all of the recommendations that your other panelists have suggested over the years and this morning in particular. But I think in addition to that, we need to think about more in terms of job training, education, and restructuring the U.S. economy along the lines of that people like Gar Alperovitz has proposed in terms of trying to cultivate more local economic development, because it's not going to happen on a global scale when global capital can move wherever it wants to enhance its profits and not care any longer about the effects that it has on local communities.
We have a tweet here, and I'll go back to our other two guests and come right back to Michael, that Munir Bahar has tweeted in that there is no war on poverty. We have to stop waging, quote-unquote, war on words. Who is accountable? I'm sorry. Who is accountable for what actions? He tweets in. Annalise, let me bring you back in very quickly here and go back to Michael. I mean, we're talking about where we are now and what, and the definitions are very different. So many ways the strategies have to be very different.
Well, I actually wanted to pick up on Michael's last point about
okay.
Stimulating local community economic development, because I think that's what began in the latter part of the war on poverty with the CETA program, Community Comprehensive Education Training Act, and the Youth Employment Training Program, that both of which were initiated and expanded under Nixon and Carter. And I think that we have not gone far enough with this idea of economic development through service delivery. So you had a lot of, certainly the women I write about in Las Vegas and a lot of the women in the welfare rights movement were able to use war on poverty programs to do meaningful work in their own communities and begin to get a salary. And if you could, then bring in a public-private partnership, which began to happen toward the end of the war on poverty with the Ford Foundation and other foundations becoming involved in this, you can begin to get community economic development in a meaningful way. And that has not disappeared. There are something like 1,100 community development corporations across the country still today. And I think that that's one key way to go. And part of that involved counseling poor women in particular, but poor people in general on how to start little businesses in their own communities, in communities that were really business deserts and where there was some fertile ground for new businesses to start. And that's been key for women anyway. Starting their own businesses has been central in the last 40 years to helping, to alleviate to some extent the poverty rate among women. But the other thing is that when Senator Russell Long of Louisiana framed the earned income tax credit in the early 70s, he envisioned a negative income tax as part of what would help the working poor, but he also envisioned a massive public jobs program, and that never really got off the ground. Now, I understand the political climate is difficult for that sort of thing now, but I think we need to go back to talking about it, because in many of these communities, private investment fled a long time ago, and it's really only the federal government that has the kinds of resources necessary to spark some of the revival that we can see in those areas. And, you know, we're still honoring the roads and bridges and post offices and parks and murals and all the things created in the early years of the New Deal. I think we could see a kind of flourishing revival along those lines.
The other aspect of that, which I completely agree with, is that public sector investment is really a transfer of costs that otherwise would be borne by the private sector, and it's enhanced the economic growth of the private sector. So it's a strange contradiction that public sector investment is opposed by the very forces which in the past have gained enormously from it, because it's essentially a transfer of the infrastructure costs, both physical and social infrastructure costs, from private sector to the public sector, and it is one of the factors, not the only one, but one of the factors that led to the growth of the American economy between the Second World War and the mid-1970s.
Timothy, go ahead.
With anything that's been said, I think it's important to point out there are things that can and must be done now to prevent poverty from getting even worse. Right now, Congress is considering proposals to cut the food stamp program at a time when it was already cut only a few months ago, at a time when it's the crucial economic support for millions of low-income people. Unless Congress extends the unemployment compensation, the federal unemployment compensation program, hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of people will lose unemployment insurance benefits and be thrown into poverty. And President Obama has proposed, and others in Congress have proposed, a significant increase in minimum wage, which I think is absolutely imperative if we're going to do anything to reduce the growing gap in, between those at the bottom and those in the middle and at the top.
We have about 5 minutes left in the segment, so Mike, why don't you pick up before we go to the phones at 410-319-8880. I see Bruce has called back in.
Well, two quick points, Mark. Thank you. First of all, I think whether we use the metaphor of war or not, we have to fight more than on one front, because people are poor for very different reasons. What we've attempted to do sometimes throughout our history is fight poverty that is a result of people's situations, being elderly, being disabled, being poor for, quote, no fault of their own. But what we've not done, and what some of the other panelists have talked about, is that we've not addressed the structural causes of poverty. About over 40 years ago, Herbert Gans, the sociologist, wrote a book called The Uses of Poverty. And poverty serves a lot of economic, social, and political purposes that are often overlooked. And so I think we've never really addressed the structural causes in any kind of a war. And those are directly related to the growing inequality in the United States. My second point is an example of that. Because we have allowed, particularly since the late 70s or early 80s, the growth of what Nixon called the new federalism, we have enormous regional differences not only in the level of poverty and the nature of poverty, but in government responses to poverty. I mean, one clear example of that is the refusal of about half of our states to expand Medicaid. Another is the proportion of funds that they spend per pupil on education. The cost of public higher education varies enormously among states. Housing costs and the level of the minimum wage or unemployment benefits or TANF benefits are widely variant. And it just seems to me, it strikes me as somewhat insane or irrational that you cross an artificially drawn political line and your life chances are affected enormously because of who controls the state legislature and the state house.
So, Annalise, very quickly before we have to take a break here, as a historian and someone who's covered these movements, how do you project where we are now, 2014?
Well, I think, I want to agree that the Affordable Care Act is tremendous, the expansion of Medicaid. There's a lot of good going on now, and we have to recognize the fact that programs like food stamps are not you know, they're not up for grabs anymore. I mean, it's one in six, between one in six and one in seven Americans who now depend on them. So I think that the idea is to build on that. And one key part of that is to stop demonizing the poor, and particularly poor mothers. They are not the cause of it. They are of entrenched poverty. They make mistakes like everybody else. But they're the folks who've been carrying poor kids on their backs literally for generations and continuing to try to give them better lives. And so I think if we stop denigrating the poor and demonizing them, there'll be more political sympathy for expanding programs to help them.
I would totally agree. I totally agree with that. The other thing is, I think, to link the struggle against poverty with the struggle against inequality, because one of the reasons that the war on poverty went off track was that there was the perception in the public minds that it was targeted only at certain individuals, and given the persistent racism in our society, it was perceived to be only targeted at people of color. I think as people more and more recognize that what's going on structurally in the U.S. and global economy is affecting almost all Americans, that we've got to somehow link our anti-poverty strategies with our anti-inequality strategies at the same time. I think that's the basis of a political coalition for the future.
And a finally 30-second thought, Timothy Casey?
Well, I my thought would be I agree with what the U.S. things have just said, so I really have nothing more to add.
Okay.
To that.
Well, I want to thank all. This has been fascinating. Timothy Casey is director of Women in Poverty Program at Legal Momentum. Dr. Annalise Orlick is professor of history at Dartmouth College. He wrote this incredible book, Storming Caesar's Palace, How Black Mothers Fought Their Own War on Poverty. I think one day soon we'll have her on just to talk about that book. Even though it's not a new book, it's something we all should be reading. And I want to thank Dr. Michael Raich for joining us here at the Daniel Thurs Distinguished Professor of Social Justice here at the University of Maryland, and earlier Dr. Peniel Joseph, Professor of Tufts University. Thank the four of you so much. It's been great to have you with us.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
We're going to take a brief break. When we come back, we're going to have an ideological debate over what to do about poverty in America now. So stay tuned for that. We're going out with Johnny Cash, Folsom Prison. He first sang this song in 1968 and was a hit. Black, white, Latino prisoners love Johnny Cash, and he caused a lot of ruckus with this one. We'll be right back.
And time keeps dragging on, but that train keeps rolling on down to San Antone. When I was just a baby, my mama told me, son, always be a good boy, don't ever play with guns. But I shot a man and
by the Nile bank, the Saint Mary's Needle, cradle of bulrushes, a man suckling combat, stone horned, stone bearded, heart of stone.
Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. Good to have you here with us. We're going to continue our conversation. That was DJ Spooky, James Joyce. James Joyce, of course, passed away on this day, and remember him on this day, one of the great writers of all time. And we honor his life on this day, remembering his death. We are joined here in studio. Find all my notes. Who am I with? Yes, here I am. I'm here in the studio with Jeff Singer, founder and former executive director of Healthcare for the Homeless, instructor at the University of Maryland School of Social Work, and Rachel Sheffield, a policy analyst in the DeVos Center for Religion and Civil Society at the Heritage Foundation. Welcome back, Rachel. Good to have you back with us again.
Thank you.
And Imara Jones is back with us once again, who just finished writing some really interesting pieces on the war on poverty. He's economic justice contributor for CarlLinus.com. He also served in the Clinton White House on international trade policy. Imara, how are you? Welcome back.
I'm well. How are you? Happy New Year.
Same to you. And Happy New Year to you all.
Thank you.
And you can join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. You can join us and tweet us, or you can just jump on our Facebook page. On our way, let me remind you, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeCube, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeCube, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeCube invests in you. More information, www.mecu.com. Join us here, 410-319-8888. Those of you who didn't get in the last segment, join us now. We'll get you in. 410-319-8888. So here we are in a situation that, in seemingly contradictory world, maybe it's not. You have the Hamilton Project that said that nearly half of all Americans are at or near poverty. And then the Jared Bernstein Center for Budget and Policy Development Jared Bernstein at the Center for Budget and Policy Development, said that the poverty rate would be 30%, if not 15%, by this definition, if it had not been for the war on poverty, and the poverty is, you know, has gone down. We're at like 19%. So, or he said 16%, and by maybe new definitions, 19%. So, but what does that mean? Because I think these are contradictory ideas. Amara, you want to start off?
Well, I don't think that they're contradictory ideas. I mean, the fact is that there are two different measurements. The first measurement is that given where we are now, and given, you know, the lowest wages in 40 years, and given the fact that we are probably 9 or 10 million jobs below what we need to be over the long term, given the fact that the labor force participation rate is the lowest it's been in 40 years, all these superlatives, it's pushed Americans to the economic edge, which is why in that Hamilton Project report, they said that half of Americans are either in poverty or one paycheck away from economic crisis. But at the same time, if we hadn't had the war on poverty and the Great Society programs, if we hadn't had those programs that emphasize economic opportunity and provided a bridge for tens of millions of Americans, we would have actually 40 million more people in poverty last year. So the situation would be even worse. And so those things go together. And what they show is that for the time that they were instituted, those programs worked. I would argue as an economist that by any measure, those programs are successful. If you're able to keep 40 million people out of poverty each year, that's something that's working. But because there hasn't been an updated push on inequality, there hasn't been an updated push on poverty to reflect the changes in our economy that need to be addressed so that even more people can have opportunity, there's been a lapse. And so what we need to do is we need to update our efforts. We need to update the entire War on Poverty and Great Society programs to match an economy that's going into the 21st century so that we can actually do a better job of actually bringing down the poverty rate. And just to emphasize one other thing that you brought up on a technical point, hopefully people won't fall asleep, that 19% measure is there's an argument that for a really long time that the way that the government measures poverty is actually inaccurate. And his argument or his data was that if you change that measurement, we're in even worse shape. But even with that change in the way that they, you know, we may measure poverty, the war on poverty itself still keeps tens of millions of people out of poverty every year. And so I think that all these things go together.
Rachel?
Yeah, so just in response to that comment, I mean, yes, we have spent, we do have a welfare state that is large. We spend nearly $1 trillion a year, and since the war on poverty started 50 years ago, we've spent nearly $20 trillion. So certainly those programs have contributed to boosting the material well-being of America's low-income populations. However, to call them a success, I think, is not quite accurate. I mean, yes, we have, you know, artificially boosted the living standards of America's poor, but as far as actually helping individuals become self-sufficient, we've failed. I mean, if we look at the poverty rate back in the mid-1960s and today, I mean, it has remained pretty much unchanged since that time. I mean, it's fluctuated some, but it's basically been the same. And, you know, and part of that reason is because much of welfare spending isn't included when calculating poverty. But while our poverty measure may not really be a great measure of poverty, I think it's a good measure of self-sufficiency. And by that measure, we have not helped more Americans become self-sufficient through our welfare policies. Our welfare system has poured more dollars at the symptoms of poverty while failing to address the causes, while failing to help individuals become self-reliant.
Mark, can I just address a technical point here?
Mm-hmm. Please go ahead.
Two things. First of all, welfare and the welfare state is a misnomer. We don't have welfare anymore. Welfare, as Republicans continue to label it or think of it, died in the mid-1990s. The welfare program is actually far, 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 far smaller. I think it's a third of the size. That's because there are work requirements. There's a five-year lifetime cap. They've made it a lot harder. So welfare, that doesn't really exist anymore. And it certainly doesn't exist to a tune of $1 trillion. That $1 trillion number that they use actually includes all social spending for every single program, including Medicare and Medicaid and a whole host of things, housing, student loans. It basically includes all non-defense. All non-defense spending in the budget is what they include in that $1 trillion a year. So by that measure, then that means if you receive help on your FHA loan or your student loan, then you are included in their definition of the welfare state. And the real reality is that those programs actually spur opportunity. They help people buy homes. They help people go to college. And so this idea that we have a $1 trillion welfare state that is creating some type of dependency is just not matched by the facts. And the only way that argument can be made is if we include all non-defense spending in what the government lays out every year.
Before Rachel comes again, Jeff, let me bring you in here, then we'll bring Rachel right back in.
Thank you. You invited me here because I actually disagree with both of your guests, and I'll explain why. First, I really don't understand how the war on poverty has reduced poverty. In fact, I think credible economists will say that poverty was being reduced at the conclusion of World War II, and through the war on poverty, it actually flattened the reduction. Most of the reduction, the important parts came when Social Security kicked in for people who were now retiring with full Social Security benefits in the 60s. So poverty among seniors was reduced from about 30% down to 9%. That's very important. That's good. The reduction in poverty for children happened not because of the war on poverty primarily, but because of court cases, which opened up barriers to AFDC so more children were eligible. I think there's not real good evidence that the war on poverty had an important effect on the poverty rate. It had some. What it didn't do was provide much in the way of jobs for people. It wasn't actually a job program. It was a job opportunity program. It was a training and education program. And later in the program, I'll discuss, I think, the actual fundamental tenets of the war on poverty. But I don't think it had a big effect on the one hand. On the other hand, I don't know what self-sufficiency is. I drove here today in a car that I didn't build and wouldn't know how, on roads that I didn't create and wouldn't know how, and I went to a school that hundreds and hundreds and thousands of people contributed to making the schools work. I don't know what self-sufficiency is, and I don't think it's worthwhile to talk about making people self-sufficient. So there's that issue as well on the right and in the liberal area. What we really ought to talk about is how to restructure the economy so that instead of attacking poor people and saying that the cause of poverty is that these people are defective and we have to change them through training and education and so forth, is how do we build an economy based on producing what people need, not on producing profits?
All right, let me take this one step at a time. And let me start with this whole notion of before we get self-sufficiency, Rachel, I want to get with this whole notion of what the war on poverty did. I mean, there are people who argue, Imara, and then we'll come back to all other guests as well, that in some of the stats, the things I've read leading up to the show, that our poverty rate would be 40% higher than it is today, and some of that they made this too high, would be higher than it is today if it was not for the LBJ's war on poverty that had kept people from poverty. It kept and it moved and helped create this large black middle class that we have in America today that wouldn't have been here without the war on poverty. Imara?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the argument here is not the war on poverty by itself. That was a cornerstone of the larger Great Society. So in the war on poverty, there are a couple of parts. There's the job training program that was just mentioned. There was food assistance, and then there was an education component. The job creation part of the job opportunity part has gone. The education and the food assistance pieces have remained. And the larger parts of the Great Society have, of course, stayed around in terms of housing and Medicaid and Medicare. And the list really goes on. Every single major social program that exists today is a result of the Great Society and the war on poverty minus Social Security. And so I think that if you take those programs out of the economic picture, because what they were designed to do was to create a bridge from poverty to work and to the middle class, they keep 40 million people out of poverty every year. So the poverty rate would be double. And I don't see how that's not a success. Now, the question is how it bends the long-term curve of poverty. And there are a lot of things that impact that, including the structure of our economy. I think creating an economy that works for everybody is, of course, what's key to reducing the poverty rate. In the Clinton administration, when we had the strongest economic growth since World War II and the broadest economic growth since World War II, the poverty rate actually came down to 11.8%, 12%, well below what it is today. And that's because there was a promotion of an economy that works for everybody. And so what we need to do is to talk about that. But to say that the war on poverty isn't a success because it hasn't zeroed out poverty, I think is wrong. I think any type of program that keeps 40 million people out of poverty every year is a success. Has it zeroed out poverty? No. Do we need to do more? Yes. And there are a whole host of things that can be done to do that, such as, you know, we could raise the minimum wage, and that's going to lift 5 million people out of poverty and raise the wages of 27 million people right off the bat. That's an easy thing, and we could do that at $10 an hour. And we can go on and on and on. But I think to what has happened over the past 50 years is that we've said because poverty isn't zero, these programs were worthless. That's actually not borne out by the fact. Sorry.
And before Jeff, you run back in to respond, Rachel, your thoughts again.
I guess a lot of different angles to take on
this. Go ahead.
I mean, I guess first of all, I mean, again, going back to the point that, you know, has our welfare system, has it touched poverty? And I would argue that yeah, it has materially boosted living standards of poor Americans. I mean, you know, we look at if we actually look at what poverty is in the United States, you know, we see that the average poor household, I mean, they're doing okay. I mean, as far as being able to have enough food to eat and living in comfortable housing, you know, the average poor American, they have a car, they have a home that's equipped with air conditioning, they have cable TV, TVs, DVD players. So, you know, it's definitely poverty today is definitely, you know, defined very differently than what it was back in the 1960s. But the problem is that our welfare system, I mean, when we talk about, when we go back to the war on poverty, when we go back to LBJ's own statements, I mean, he said himself that, you know, that the war on poverty was not simply to address the symptoms, but to address the causes and to prevent it ultimately and provide opportunity, not doles. You know, today, if we look at work rates among low-income households, we see that, you know, they're low, even in good economic times. So our welfare system really should encourage work for able-bodied adults, and yet the vast majority of our welfare programs, and yes, we do still have a welfare state. I mean, back in 1996, we had welfare reform, but that touched one program of nearly 80. And you know, I would argue that food stamps, for example, I mean, that is a program that provides welfare, housing programs, healthcare programs. I mean, there's dozens of them. We spend a great deal on these programs, and yet they're not based on that principle of encouraging work. And you know, that's what 1996 did. It inserted a work requirement into the largest cash assistance program, and from that, we saw welfare rolls decline by half within about 5 years. We saw employment rates among low-income individuals increase, and we saw child poverty drop. So in many ways, it was a success, but that reform has been watered down. And again, it touched just one program of nearly 80 today. And so if we really want to help people, we should encourage work among able-bodied adults. We provide the assistance. We have a safety net, but encourage work for those who are able-bodied. And I think by those types of reforms, that's how we really encourage people to be able to contribute, to be able to get back on their feet.
I need to invite Rachel on a drive-along. I worked for the War on Poverty in West Baltimore for 20 years, and really people are not living as well as you think they are. People don't have cars and they don't have air-conditioned houses. They don't have subsidized housing for the most part. There's 42,000 households in Baltimore that can't pay their rent each month, and the rent they're paying are for places that can't pass minimal inspections.
Well, I mean, I'm just looking at, this is referring to government data, looking at, the government's own data, looking at, average poverty. And I'm not arguing that those, that low-income people, that, that they're not struggling, that they don't have problems. But what I'm saying is that, when we compare poverty today to what it was 50 years ago, I mean, it is very different. It isn't what most people think of when they think of poverty. And, I'm not arguing that we don't want to help people. But, I mean, my question is then how, if we were going to win this war on poverty by spending, we would have done it already. And I don't think that by continuing to just pour more at the symptoms that we're going to succeed.
Well, let me let Jeff finish his thought and let Amara jump back in here as well. Jeff?
Well, let me briefly support Amara's position on this 80 welfare programs that the government spends $1 trillion on. I've read the Congressional Research Service's report on that matter that Jeff Sessions from Alabama had commissioned, and it's absurd. Most of those programs are not. No one would consider them to be welfare programs except extreme right-wing folks. What they are, programs like Medicaid and Medicare, they're not welfare programs. But most of the money that they spend also goes to make profits for the health industrial complex. The $1 trillion that you're talking about mostly goes for the 1% of the population that controls between 20 and 40% of the wealth in the United States. That's where the welfare payments are going, both in corporate tax subsidies and through these programs that give for-profit companies and nonprofits as well the means to provide some services and to take the profits out of them. And we need to address that if we want to address poverty. But let me say one more thing, that we can't end poverty through a war on poverty, just like we can't end homelessness through a war on homelessness. We have to restructure the economy and the political structure as well so that we all are making the decisions about how our money is being spent.
And so, Amara, I'm curious. You've been in and out of the White House and now a commentator. So how do you – and we all sometimes wrestle between – what people call real politique of ending poverty, because poverty is immense in America. When you read the Hamilton Project, which I cited earlier, that nearly half of all Americans are at or near poverty, that's a very stunning number. Do we have to go beyond the real politique to begin to address the issue?
Well, I think that we have to roll back the political stigmatization and the racial stereotyping of the programs in order to be able to move forward. I think that one of the things that's interesting is that when you say war on poverty, it gets filtered through a political lens, no matter which side of the spectrum you're on, that obscures actually what the facts are about the result of the war. I think, and it's the war on poverty plus the Great Society. I think we have to expand that. And I think that it immediately gets filtered through, and particularly a generational lens about what things meant and how they are, and look at what the reality was. And a couple of things. First of all, the war on poverty was never fully fought. If it was a down payment on economic justice in this country, then it was a down payment that wasn't fully realized. As Sergeant Shriver said, who was President Kennedy's brother-in-law and who ran the war on poverty out of the White House for President Johnson, said the war on poverty was killed by the war in Vietnam, mainly due to a lack of funding. That's almost a direct quote. And the second thing is that although Johnson's public pronouncements were sweeping about the war on poverty, and he realized that they had to be in order to motivate members of Congress to take, at that time, which a big step to vote for something that was unpopular amongst a lot of Democrats, particularly Southern Democrats, so he had to make it sound sweeping. He actually turned to Bill Moyers when he introduced the bill and said, this bill won't solve poverty, but it's a start. And I think that if you look at it through that lens, that it was a start, it was a down payment that wasn't fully realized, then what's actually amazing is that a lot of those programs continue to exist and that they continue to have an impact. So one of them, Head Start, which is had like 15 million people. I think Rachel may have even written about this at one point, has made a huge impact on the early educational opportunities of poor particularly Black and Latino children, and that program is still around. And on it goes. And I think that one of the things that we do to ourselves a disservice is that because poverty in this country doesn't look like poverty in the developing world, we say that people aren't struggling, and that's just not the reality. A series on homeless children in New York that just ran in the New York Times on this one child, Dasani, and their extreme abject poverty is the fact that it's 10 people to a room in a homeless shelter, and the fact that there are rats and the food is often rancid that they serve there, and that they have to put up whatever they have and hang it from a post in the room so that rats won't get to it, on and on and on. One of the interesting things that the reporter who wrote the story said is that these children are hidden because when you see them walking on the street, they don't look as if they live in a place where the food is rancid and they have to hang food from the ceiling in order from rats to be able to get to it. And that's because a lot of times the clothing that they are able to have access to in a wealthy city like New York is what kids on the Upper East Side would wear because it's donated clothing. And so they don't look like they're poor kids. And so poverty in the United States is actually cloaked. But if you peel behind the cloak, it is really extreme in terms of the choices that people have to make. And so we have to get beyond this idea that that poverty is a deficiency, that somehow if I don't see you starving in the streets, that you're not poor and you're not struggling, and that we actually don't have a responsibility to other people.
When we look at these stats, though, how much time we have left in the segment? We have 2 minutes left in this, and we're going to spill over? Yes? No? What are we doing? We're not. Okay. So a closing thought. Let me get you to jump in here, Rach. We have like 2 minutes left. I want to get you to respond for a minute.
Sure. Absolutely. Yeah. Definitely people are struggling in this country, and I think the question we need to ask is why. I mean, if we look back at since the 1960s, those institutions that fight poverty, that protect against poverty, such as work and marriage, particularly the family, those things have disintegrated. Unwed childbearing, 4 out of 10 children today in the United States is born to single parents. Children in single-parent homes are more than 5 times as likely to be poor as their peers born to married parent families. And yet, this problem continues that our welfare system and society fails to address that issue of marriage and the family. And that if we hope to address poverty, that is a crucial component that we can't overlook. We also need to encourage work. Our welfare system, it should encourage work for able-bodied adults. Yes, Americans are generous people. They want to help their neighbors, but they believe that their neighbors should also help themselves, and our welfare system needs to be designed on that principle of
We do have to take a break here. I'll remind everybody as we go to break here. I'm sorry, Rich, we do have to get a legal break here on public radio. That a quarter of the jobs we have in America are below the poverty line of $23,000 a year. Half the jobs are below $34,000 a year in America. That people don't make enough to survive is the problem, even with the jobs we have. So I think that's that. When we looked at what happened with President Clinton, and TANF, it worked sort of in the 90s, sort of, but then the economy fell apart and people got shoved back into poverty because they lost the jobs that they had. And so we have to leave it there for this moment because we have to take a break. Rachel Sheffield is always great to have you with us from the Devo Center Heritage Foundation, policy analyst. Imara Jones, my brother's always good to have you with us.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Economic Justice contributor for Color Lines. We'll be posting their articles at steinershow.org. And right after the show, you can see everything they've written and also how to communicate with them. We will be right back as we continue our look at the war on poverty. Jeff Singer stays with us. We bring in people who are organizing around poverty issues and talk about what they see. Stay with us.
Temptation's page flies out the door. You follow, find yourself at war. Watch waterfalls of pity roar. You feel the moan, but unlike before, you discover that you just be one more person crying. So don't fear if you hear a foreign sound.
It's all right, Ma. I'm only bleeding, says Bob Dylan. Recorded on this day in 1966, so we honor him and that song as well. Remind you on our way to this conversation that the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by the Maryland State Education Association. From school funding to Common Core, you can learn about the important issues impacting Maryland students, parents, and schools by visiting the Maryland State Education Association's website at MarylandEducators.org. That's MarylandEducators.org. Or you can join us here. You can go to thesteinershow.org and click on their banner. We continue our look at poverty. We're going to continue this conversation. Jeff Singer stays with us as it's the 50th anniversary of the war on poverty and where we are. At the very beginning of the show, we had Annalise Orlick on our show, who wrote a very interesting book, which we'll talk to her about separately one day soon, Storming Caesar's Palace, How Black Mothers Fought Their Own War on Poverty, which analyzed poor people's movements in the struggle to take control of their own lives and also to change the nature of what we do in this country. So having heard her, it's important now to kind of talk about what people are actually doing on the ground here in our own communities that are struggling on the issues of poverty. Obviously, we were walking out of the library last night, Valerie and I. We walked past the Union Headquarters Unite here where it says Workers United. Today we have Workers United and United Workers all coming here together. Jeff Singer remains with us. He's founder and former executive director of Healthcare for the Homeless, instructor at the University of Maryland School of Social Work. Mike Hatchie is with us. Mike Hatchie is a Unite Here organizer on the airport campaign. And Gutwende Yamayo, I got that right?
Yes.
Good, good. Is a cook at the Silver Diner at BWI Airport. And Gutwende, welcome to have you on the show as well, and all of you.
Thank you.
And folks, join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow at gmail.com. You can log on to our Facebook pages. You can also tweet us at Mark Steiner. There's a lot of tweets commenting on the show have come in, liking what Jeff Singer has been saying. He's got people out there following Jeff Singer now. And Dwayne has written in at steinershow@gmail.com that everyone should be guaranteed food, shelter, education, and health care. These areas should be considered as nonprofit in our economy. I don't see this changing until these are considered a right instead of a choice, writes in Dwayne. Join us here, 410-319-8888, with your thoughts and ideas about where we go from here. And what people are, and hear these stories of what people are actually doing on the ground here in Baltimore. One of the things we left with was when you look at the American economy now, I'll read this to you one more time. This is according to the Census Bureau. 104 million people, a third of the American population, have annual incomes below twice the poverty line, less than $38,000 for a family of four. Now, if that's 104 million people, that represents a great deal more, many more people, because those are people who are working, not their children who they're taking care of. And half the jobs in the nation pay less than $34,000 a year. A quarter of those jobs pay below what is considered the poverty line for a family of four of $23,000 a year. So these are the kind of the issues that America still faces. I'll talk a bit about the poverty rates in a minute. What I was saying earlier in the program, just to be clear, because I misquoted myself from the thing I was writing, which is that we have that one of the things they talked about in terms of the what happened in the war on poverty was that from food stamps to earned income tax credits and the rest, that the programs enacted kept 40 million people out of poverty that would have fallen under what are the standard guidelines for poverty. Was what I was trying to say that I misspoke earlier. So we are joined here in studio. Also, Luis Laron is joining us. Luis, of course, is the leadership organizer with United Workers. So we have United Workers, Workers United, and Jeff Singer. 410-319-8888 to join this conversation. Whoever is calling in, we'll get your calls in just a minute. So welcome. Good to have you all in the studio.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So let's talk about where those stats were given out. You heard some of the show maybe coming into the studio here, and we've been looking at the war on poverty historically and other places. Talk about the work that's going on now, about what it means from your perspective as workers, as organizers, to organize to end poverty and organize to get people out of poverty. What does that mean? Who wants to begin? Mike Hatch.
Sure, I could begin. Hatchie. I think that... you know, the legislation and the history of it is so important. And I think in addition to the reforms from the government. The war on poverty that happens every day is the war that workers fight when they get together to organize unions and organize community organizations. I was really interested to hear your earlier guest talk about the ways that community members and women took the lead in organizing the community health centers and really fighting that war on the ground. And I think what we see today for workers who are now majority in the service sector, and this is a low-paid sector, is that real areas where we're calling on our political leadership in Maryland to take accountability and take responsibility for continuing this fight against poverty. And BWI Airport is a prime example of that, a situation where by the policies of the state of Maryland, instead of fighting poverty, we're contributing to it by creating poverty jobs. And the workers who are on the front lines fighting against poverty are the ones coming together as a union at BWI in the food and retail shops and are standing up for a fair share of the booming airport business that's coming into our state to really make sure that benefits people in Baltimore.
Kutwende, what does a fair share mean?
Fair share means the concession at the airmall and the business owners are making more money, and the workers aren't at all. We're still struggling, you know, to make it. And when you work at BWI and you're not making enough money, and you will be as, let's say you're a student, just like I am. We are struggling, right? The benefits are going on one side instead of going on both sides. So the airman is making money, the business owners are making money, but us, the workers, we are the one getting the job done. But we're still struggling to live, you know.
Luis, you've been working at this for how many years now?
In the U.S., around seven and a half years.
Right. And
yeah.
Your life has been dedicated to this, whether you were...
Right.
Right, wherever you've been. Yeah. So I'm curious what you see in... not what you see, but when you have the work you're doing in United Workers, and you have work you see being done in labor unions organizing the unorganized, are they different? I mean, how do we come together to kind of address the issue in a united way? I mean, how do you see this transpiring in America?
Yeah, you know, for us in the United Workers, it is about how we unite in our differences and not necessarily what we have in common, right? So, there is the tendency of fighting for our own cause, or based on our race, based on our gender, or based on any kind of divisions, you know, versus coming together in one simple thing, which is poverty, you know, which we have been, the United States is, it experienced a lot of poverty and a lot of social problems that are not getting addressed by attack the root and the structure that is causing these problems. It's more, has been, for a while, has been attacking by piece by piece, right? And that is actually creating more disorganization and creating more divisions, that it is allowing to the system and the structures to take advantage of that and actually keep the conditions in the way that they are. So in the United Workers ideology, we think that we can come together as human beings, and that's one of the reasons why we use the human rights framework to unite people, right? And then one of the examples is the Fair Development Campaign that we have been working with Unite Here, right? It is in other unions, in other faith organizations, in other community organizations. It is a perfect example that we come together for one cause and call it Fair Development Campaign, which is attacking in different ways these structures that are keeping or workers and the at the airport that are keeping students at the high school in Brooklyn, you know, on poverty and creating the situation that we are dealing with. So that's how we see it.
Jeff, I mean, you've been, I mean, a long time, whether it's been helping to found health care for the homeless and staying active in the struggle to end poverty. I'm curious, again, all of your perspectives and yours now about what that struggle means and where, what form does it take here in 2014? Unite Here is organizing, obviously, as a labor union, but the labor unions were industrial unions, have lost a lot of power, lost a lot of members, lost a lot of influence. Some people say that that we're organizing in the wrong place for the most part. So, I mean, what do you see this that we're coming out in this 20th century, 21st century?
Right, organizing in the wrong places and also organizing to defend and support the Democratic Party, and how your previous guest could defend Bill Clinton on the subject of poverty is just staggering to those of us who saw the damage that the man did. But let me talk a little bit about the organizing that's happening now. That in just in Baltimore City, it's a very vibrant place. It's wonderful. For example, with United Workers, Housing Our Neighbors, Word on the Street, Be More Housing for All, the Homeless Speakers Bureau, we're all getting together to both do political work and to study it. We're creating a college, a sort of a hobo college. We're meeting regularly, talk about the commodification of everyday life, including the commodification of housing, which is the fundamental cause of homelessness. So we're meeting, we're learning, and then we're acting. We've been down at City Hall numerous times, for example, trying to keep the city from subsidizing wealthy developers rather than putting money into communities that need it, despite what your previous guest said about people with air conditioning and so forth. We're trying to create an inclusionary housing program in Baltimore that works, wherein wealthy developers who get subsidies from the city will build housing that's affordable to people, because we have such a dearth of it that there are 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 people every night sleeping on the streets, under bridges, in abandoned houses. So we're working on these issues very actively, and I'm excited about it.
So you see something seething from below that we don't see covered very much in the press.
Sure. Let me also mention what happened in Lorain, Ohio recently in the last elections at the end of 2012, when 12 labor organizers ran on an independent labor ticket and took city council seats in 4 cities in Lorain County, Ohio, to oppose the Democratic Party structures, because what were the Democrats doing but supporting the Republicans? Like Huey Long said, you know, the Democrats and Republicans, they both serve the meals, but they're prepared in the same Wall Street kitchen.
That's a great line.
Yeah, he was a pretty great man.
So, again, when you see this, I mean, organizing against power, organizing for power, organizing for that kind of change is very hard, especially it's difficult to do. I mean, I'm curious how you see, since you've been around a long time and you guys are relatively young compared to this guy over here and to me, how is it different now than it was in the 60s or even the 30s in terms of the kind of organizing you're doing and what you expect and how you expect this change to come about to end poverty?
Well, I would say that one of the differences is that we're in more urgent state than 30 years ago. If you remember, like Dr. King starting the Poor People's Campaign and this war on poverty that Lyndon Johnson declared, the United States was in a totally different economic and political stage, and the inequality, quote unquote, wasn't that bad, and people were like the production and the income for people was also a little bit more hand to hand. There was not too much need of going debt. There was not too much of there was more strong unions. There was the political arena was totally different. And the fact that a president come forward and say I'm declaring war on poverty, it is something that now we don't see at all. Like in the for the politicians. The fight on poverty is nothing but extend or cut the food stamps or any other social services, but not attacking any type, but not talking clearly about we are in poverty and this is a problem that we need to address, and also when we talk about poverty, we always look at the extreme poverty that is in South Africa, that is in Africa, that is in Latin America, that is in any other place but the United States. And I think that that's one of the differences is that the political arena, the economic arena in the U.S. is very different. And I think like because of that, that's also the different tactics of organizing. I mean, now we are talking more about a globalized market versus back in the day, there was not as big as now. There was not automation, so there was more need of workers. And now we need to create different strategies. You know, like in housing, like Jeff was talking, United Workers and I saw the groups are coming together to talk about like what are the other alternatives for housing, because right now, because the housing is so commodified, you cannot get a house unless you work, unless you earn money, and there is no other way to have a house with dignity. However, there is other things. There is other places where community land trust, for example, has been working well, and it's a new, different thing to organize around versus just what happens before 20 years ago.
I think one of the defining things about organizing as workers in 2014 is that when workers come together to organize a union, even when they're on a state-owned property like Baltimore, Washington, Thurgood Marshall Airport, they are going to face a vicious counterattack from their employers.
What kind of vicious counterattack are you talking about?
Well, let me open it up to Gutwende.
Yeah, organizing at the diner was very, very difficult because you're going to have your buses on your back. Me personally, when we started to organize, I had to meet with my the head manager 3 times. He came up to me because he saw this this protest that we had. We had the first protest, and it was where there was pictures on the newspapers, and he showed me the picture and was like, "Is that you?" I said, "Yes." He was like, "You don't need to organize. We don't need union here, you know, because he believes that we have the best job ever. We have all the benefits that we have, that we deserve to have, and you know, and that the union gonna destroy the family of the diner." And it is pretty hard to organize today because your boss is gonna come after you, you know, and I remember we did this action. We buttoned up with the union logo, and they made some of us take it off. Me, they made me take it off, and they were like, "It's not part of the uniform policy, but it is my legal right to wear a union button at work."
And I think that's so worth emphasizing, these actions that Gutwende is talking about, participating in a demonstration, wearing a union button. These are basic First Amendment freedom of speech rights. And in 2014, the fact is when workers use their freedom of speech, they come under attack.
So when you look at this kind of broader spectrum we're facing here, I mean, when I said earlier that nearly half of Americans live near or at poverty in America, that can mean many things. I mean, the situation of poverty was different in the early 60s because you did have malnutrition. People were living in shacks without plumbing. That stuff was real. And even in Baltimore City, there were people who lived without plumbing in the early 60s and the right kind of sanitation. That kind of stuff changed. That ended for the most part in this community, except for people who are at the very bottom and folks who are in and out of homelessness, which are a good 40,000 people in the city of Baltimore, right? So but to me, to make this change that you all are talking about when we're addressing poverty, has to kind of be a very broad group of people coming together to make it happen. As a former organizer myself, it's very difficult to do that kind of organizing because everything is so transient. People are transient, and without some structure to kind of pull that together to demand that kind of change from the local level, I mean, it's a hard process.
Absolutely, and I think what we've seen at the airport is that jobs made more and more transient. Just a few years ago, there used to be one company that ran food and retail at the airport. Now there's a developer and 42 different subcontractors. So not only do the workers come in and out, the companies come in and out, and we've seen people get laid off up to 100 people at a time just because their employer changed. And I absolutely agree with you that real change is broad. It's a big group of people, and I just want to call back to what Luis said earlier. I think what is really uniting us now in the city of Baltimore is this slogan, this campaign for fair development, you know, and that's what links up the struggle at the airport also with the struggle of the high school students in Curtis Bay. We were proud to be out there protesting the construction of that incinerator that's now planned to pollute the air in some of the poorest neighborhoods in our city. And I do think it has to be more than any one single issue or cause, but it has to be based in organizing deeply and tightly in many different struggles and really building a base of power.
And indeed, it is beginning to happen. You know, a couple of years ago when we were protesting against downtown waterfront development, it would be 5, 6, or 7 of us,
right,
you know, in front of City Hall. This year, Harbor East attracted a wonderful coalition of community folks. The people from Perkins Homes were there. 3 unions were there. The homeless organizers were there. And we packed City Hall. And while we didn't win what we wanted to, we began to create connections and relations. So I think this is building. You're right, Mark. It's very difficult. It will take a long time. But organizing around fair development, around not just opportunities for everyone, but a good life for everyone. I don't even like the word opportunity. It's so nebulous. Yes, the market will somehow give you an opportunity. Well, it's the market that's the cause of our problems. Let's shut down the market. Let's produce what people need. And when we create that kind of economy all together in a democratic way, then we'll have the life that we want.
Mm-hmm. Luis, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I think both Mike and Jeff make a good point. And one of the things that United Workers put a lot of emphasis on is what Jeff mentioned before, which is the study, right? Like, there is no way that we can organize and come together unless we really prepare ourselves intellectually to what we are up against. I mean, the market is not dumb. The market is really smart and has been developed a strategy and a system that works perfectly for them. And the market is working as was designed for. And in order for us to create real change, we also need to be smarter than the market, smarter than the system. And that's the key for organizing, for real unity and for come together and really, if we are talking about end poverty from the structure and from the root of the problem, then it is not easy at all. That's for sure. But the coming together needs to happen more into the ideologies and not just necessarily into the bodies. And like we have 100 people or versus 1,000 people, but it's actually what is our vision and how do we ambition the change and versus just how many people we had protesting against this developer that very few people know. And that's one of the other differences, right? That before you could target very well a company that was very well known. Now we have so many developers that are not even in people's radar. It's like, who you are talking about? I don't know that guy. Who is getting how much money? Okay, I don't even know who that person is, right? That's why we need to come together in a very radical and different way that we did it before.
And I think you can see this happening here. You can see it happening across the country. There's a bubbling up from the bottom that is often dismissed because it's not covered by the mainstream media very much.
Mm. Right.
So it can be seen to be, you can allow it to look marginalized as opposed to being much more powerful than we want to think.
Sure, Richmond, California is seizing houses at eminent domain. A socialist has just been elected to the Seattle City Council. Organized to occupy houses is happening all over the country to prevent evictions. You know, back to the point you were making earlier, the great Hyman Minsky said that the war on poverty was a conservative rebuttal to an ancient challenge of the radicals that capitalism necessarily generates poverty, right? The war on poverty was part of this market orientation. It served many purposes, including it deflected attention away from the economic structures that produce and recreate poverty and homelessness. It did provide some jobs for middle-class folks, including minority folks. It did do those things. But it also prevented us from focusing on redistributing power. And that's what we're doing now. We're focusing on redistributing power.
And I would add to that list of recent victories the Seattle-Tacoma Airport, where recently voters approved setting the living wage at $15 an hour for airport workers. You know, and I think in many ways we're known as a progressive state, but to stay on the example of the airport, today, right now, there's no law requiring anything higher than the $7.25 minimum wage. There's no guaranteed paid sick days, and there's no guarantee of keeping your job when your company changes.
Well, we will continue covering this as we have, and this has been our 2-hour special on the 50th anniversary of the War on Poverty in 4 different parts. During this conversation with people who are actively organizing among the poor and poor working class people to change the nature of poverty in our society and end it. You just heard Mike Hatcher, Unite Here organizer on the airport campaign, Gutwendi Yamayogo, who is a cook at Silver Diner at BWI Airport, Luis Larin, who is leadership organizer for United Workers, and Jeff Singer, founder and former executive director of Healthcare for the Homeless, instructor at the University of Maryland School of Social Work. Thank the four of you for joining us for the closing segment here on our look at the War on Poverty.
Thank you. Energizing.
It was wonderful. It's good to have you all here.
Thanks, Mark.
Reminding you as we go out the door that the Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Mark Gunnery and Stephanie Mavronis. Our engineer is Andre Melton. Theme music by Wal Matthews of Clean Cut. You can hear this show again, find out information about all of our guests and the work that they do and what they've been writing and doing by visiting us at steinershow.org for all those links. You can also listen to and podcast all of our programs now on iTunes. And for public radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.